Hi, it's Lauren here, producer of The Brendan O'Neill Show. I just wanted to let you all know that Spike's internship program is now open for applications. We're looking for an aspiring journalist to join our team on a six-month paid full-time placement. You'd be working with us at the Spiked office in London, helping us do everything from putting out our articles to producing podcasts like this one. And you don't need any prior experience to apply. What we're looking for is someone who has a spark for journalism, writing, or podcasting, and who has a passion for our pro-freedom, pro-human message. Everything else you can learn on the job. I started at Spiked as an intern, so I can highly recommend applying for this. It's an amazing experience, and you get to earn while doing something you love. There really is nowhere better to kickstart your career in journalism. To find out more and to apply, go to spiked-online.com/interns. That's spiked-online.com/interns. You have until Sunday, the 19th of May, to apply. Good luck.
The affirmation model is terrible psychiatry. People just don't like to believe that the medics are untrustworthy. And in this area, they have let the public down in a serious way. Not just the people involved in GIDS, but also the parental bodies that should have been listening to some of the whistleblowers and saying, we need to look into what's going on here. This is not rocket science. This is a very odd thing that we're doing to healthy bodied kids and has been for a very long time.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Marcus Evans. Marcus, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
I'm really happy to have you on. I want you on because, of course, we've recently had the publication of the full publication of the CAS review. This is the review that the government commissioned into the National Health Service's gender services for young people and kids, overseen by Dr. Hilary Cass, a leading paediatrician. And the review has caused a huge storm, a lot of criticism from the trans lobby, a lot of welcoming from people who are sceptical of some of what the trans lobby says, because it is pretty severely critical. The review is pretty severely critical of some of the gender services that were being provided to kids by the NHS over the past few years. You, in your capacity as a former governor of the Tavistock Clinic, which is one of the key sources of gender services for kids in Britain, you've been raising similar concerns for a long time. The problem with how these services are provided, the ideology that often underpins them, the consequences that they can have in kids' lives. So you've been raising these issues for some time, and it seems that you and others have now been vindicated. So I guess I want to start off by asking you a pretty broad question, which is, do you feel vindicated now? Do you feel a sense of relief following the publication of the CAS review that the kind of concerns people like you have been raising are now really at the forefront of this discussion?
I mean, yes, is the short answer. But I've been in psychiatry for 45 years, and I was quite clear when hearing what was going on that there's something very wrong about what was happening in the gender services. And of course, my wife blew the whistle in 2005. So I'd heard a lot of the concerns that came up in Dave Bell's report, I'd heard in 2005. So in a sense, I've never sort of questioned the fact that my view that something very odd has gone on in this area, that usually we think psychologically about a psychological problem. When you're very quickly moving to a physical solution to a psychological problem, particularly in a place like the Tavistock, which is the National Training Centre for Psychotherapy, you realise that things have really gone off kilter. Yeah, I mean, the fact that, you know, Dave, Bell, Sue, myself and others have spoken out about this, we weren't questioning our view. But obviously, Hilary Cass coming in, it changes the game because she's not very easy to dismiss. She's got fantastic credentials. She's come in with the team from York and done a thorough deep dive into the research and the quality and lack of research. And she's come to this conclusion, as we've always been saying, that there's no evidence for this treatment. We should have been pursuing this much more cautiously, with much more interest in the outcomes, much more debate and discussion about what these kids are suffering from. And the usual thing you do in medicine, which is to look at the downside of treatment, and none of that has been going on.
So I think some people, even hearing you describe it like that, will be pretty shocked. I hope they will be shocked because, as you say, when you're providing treatment to people, medical intervention, putting people often on a medical pathway, which happened with these gender-confused kids, you would expect it to be a rigorously evidenced process, a process that had been put to the test, that we would be fairly confident that no harm would come from putting young people on this medical pathway. But that very often wasn't the case in the gender identity services provided by the NHS. As we now know, one of the things that Cass says, and some of those whistleblowers that you mentioned have already said it previously, is that young people are often put on a medical pathway to gender transition, or their gender identity was instantly accepted by some of the providers of these services with very little questioning as to whether there might be something else going on in this kid's life, and very little questioning as to whether the medical pathway was the right thing for them. So explain a little bit to us about the culture in these clinics that could allow something like that to happen with so little internal debate or internal discussion or even internal self-reflection. Had it just become so ideological that people who worked in these areas just didn't think it was necessary to have a discussion about what was right and what was wrong for some of these young people?
Yeah, I mean, these services have been running more like a customer service than a clinical service. In a clinical service, as you say, you have debate and discussion. You look at things from different points of view. And certainly from a psychological point of view, often when people are in distress, they focus down on a sort of narrow preoccupation to simplify things, as if they go, I've got one problem with one solution. So my problem is gender. And if only I could transition, everything would be okay. From a clinical point of view, you say, okay, we sort of understand that. One's compassionate. But that experience tells you that we're complicated. There are many different moving parts to ourselves. And you've got to sort of open things out, take an interest in what's going on behind the scenes. What sort of kid is this? What are the family dynamics? You don't go for this idea of a sort of magic bullet, one problem, one solution. You broaden things out. We're complicated human beings. And we need to be thinking in complex ways about the way the different aspects of the personality are interacting. And in terms of the sort of affirmation model, working in psychiatry all these years, lots of people have all sorts of beliefs. I'm not interested in butting heads with someone who thinks they're Henry VIII. I'm interested in thinking what's behind that belief and trying to understand how they've come to this belief and why it's so important that they hold on to this belief. So you're always looking behind the presenting problem to see what's going on behind the scenes and broadening the discussion out and trying to get the individual interested in who they are as a person across a broad breadth of areas. And the affirmation model does exactly the opposite. It's like someone comes in and says, well, my problem's something called gender. If only that was fixed. And then you say, well, okay, we accept you're the wrong gender and we'll help you transition. This is terrible psychiatry. You want to be empathic because the person is very invested in what they believe and you want to sort of understand that, but you're not collapsing into some agreement. You know, the art of this work is to empathize, but also broaden out the discussion, as I've said before.
So could you just tell us a little bit about what was going on? So the critical point that you've made for some time and others have too, and that's been fortified by the really thorough Cass review, is that there seemed to be two, I mean, there were many issues at the gender identity development services, but there were two issues in particular. The one was the affirmation model, as you've just mentioned there, where kids' presumed gender identity would just be very swiftly affirmed. So if a girl comes in and says, I'm a boy, then she is treated very quickly as a boy. So instant affirmation in many cases of their presumed identity. And then, of course, the medical pathway, which often included puberty blockers before questions were raised about this medication, they would often be put on puberty blockers to prevent their normal hormonal development and allow them more space, so the argument went, to think about their gender. So that was going on. How did that process work in these clinics, in these services? How quickly could a kid who attended one of these clinics expect to be affirmed and in some cases expect to be provided with particular drugs? Was it a speedy process, and how did it work inside those clinics?
The thing is I never worked in the service. My wife did, and then Dave Bell did this report. But I've now seen a lot of kids since we sort of wrote our book about a psychological approach. We've been approached by lots of parents and kids who are suffering from gender dysphoria. And you say, so if we took Keira Bell, who took over the judicial review from Sue, she had 4 appointments from 16 in which she was put on cross-sex hormones, ended up having a double mastectomy. And then at the age of 23, she decided that it hadn't dealt with the underlying problems that she'd been suffering from in the first place, and that the whole thing had been a mistake. And she was fairly determined when she was sort of pushing to be put on the medical pathway, but felt let down by psychiatric services that people hadn't been able to sort of struggle with her in thinking about what were the more complicated issues behind the scene that she felt, you know, she didn't want to tackle, as it were, but needed some support in tackling. I mean, the thing is, there were lots of different people working there, and some people did psychotherapy. Not everyone went onto the medical pathway. But there was a culture which discouraged the sort of inquiry which I've described, and the sort of inquiry which Hilary Cass is advocating. That is a holistic approach in which you're looking at the broad picture of who this kid is and trying to understand what's troubling them. So there was this tendency, let's say after 4 to 6 sessions, to affirm, yes, you're very fixed in your belief that you're the wrong gender. Now, the gender services would often sort of tout this as if this was evidence that they're doing the right thing. The kids said they were absolutely certain they were born in the wrong body. For me, that sort of fixed thinking is already problematic. You know, when you're about to do something to a healthy body, which is going to change the trajectory of your development, you'd be right to have doubts and worry that you're on the right path. The fact that all doubts are dismissed is part of the problem. When you're confronted with puberty, if you were a sort of fragile individual, you're confronted with puberty. Puberty is a massive boulder that gets thrown in the pond of the latency child. You've got the physiological, psychological, and sociological turmoil that is created by your changing body. And what a lot of these kids want to do is put a lid on that whole process. You've got all the questions that are coming at you from the adult world. What sort of sexual relationships are you going to form? What sort of adult are you going to be? Where are you going to fit in? How are you going to find your place in the adult world? And in a way, what a lot of these kids want is to put a lid on this process. In a way, you could think of it as a sort of Peter Pan syndrome. It's like suspending yourself in adolescence, if you like. One of the difficulties is, of course, the services really weren't talking about the realities of what was possible in terms of medical transition. This is the other problem. You know, the loss of the capacity to have an orgasm, sterility. There's all of the complications of taking medication, which is against your natal sex, all sorts of problems. You know, in a way, you're turning somebody who goes down the medical pathway into someone who's always going to need medical intervention. They become a physical patient for the rest of their lives. These are serious things, and they weren't being taken seriously enough. I was just going to come back to a sort of strange point, which was I used to be in charge of the adult department and had to produce outcome measures every 3 months from our commissioners, which would include, you know, what the patient's problems were, how many problems they had, what were the outcome of the psychotherapy that was given by the department, and our follow-up. I asked the medical director in my last meeting as a governor. He produced this report, which I believe was trying to bury Dave Bell's worrying report. They weren't producing a report because they really wanted to open the whole contentious area up and look at it. I thought they were trying to bury his concerns. And I said, well, where are all the outcomes? Where's the long-term follow-up studies? there were none. Now, that is shocking, absolutely shocking. You know, what on earth is going on? There's so much exceptionalism. I mean, we're attacked by people who just don't want to listen to the sorts of things that I and Hillary Cass have been saying. But there's another group who just want to believe the doctors. When I first resigned, no one else would speak out. I'd retired from the NHS, so I didn't really have to worry about my career. And for about a 5 months period before Kirsty Entwistle wrote this open letter, she worked in JIDS and she raised all sorts of problems about working there. I was contacted by the journalist who said, are you sure this isn't a one-man conspiracy theorist? Because we can't get anybody else to talk about this problem. As I say, the other issue is that people just don't like to believe that the medics are untrustworthy. And in this area, they have let the public down in a serious way. Not just the people involved in JIDS, but also the parental bodies that should have been listening to some of the whistleblowers and saying, we need to look into what's going on here. The Royal College of Psychiatry, NHS England, the CQC, until recently, they have wanted to stay out of this. And for me, most psychiatrists will tell you this is not rocket science. This is a very odd thing that we're doing to healthy body kids and has been for a very long time.
If you're a regular listener to this show or a regular reader of Spiked, why not become a Spiked supporter? Spiked supporters is our thriving community of people who donate to Spiked. Anyone who gives £5 or more a month or £50 or more a year can become a Spiked supporter and get access to lots of exciting perks. Spiked supporters can comment on articles, get free and discounted tickets to events, get a discount on all items in our shop, and bookmark articles as you browse. This is our way of saying thank you to all of you who fund our work. Spiked is completely free, and yet you still hand over your hard-earned cash to make sure that anyone, anywhere can read us and listen to us. We're incredibly grateful for your generosity. If you don't give to Spiked yet, now is the perfect time to start. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to set up your donation and your Spiked supporters account. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point that people, and this doesn't just go for the expert classes, I think it goes for some members of the public too. We don't want to think that the medics got it so catastrophically wrong. That's a scary thought to have, that there are medics within the National Health Service, within these institutions, which are often very celebrated institutions of health, who got it so badly wrong and who, in some cases, put their head in the sand and refused to look at the evidence and look at the facts. That's a scary thought to have when we're talking about the medical world. But you've touched on some really important points there about how medical practice normally works. And you've written before that in your capacity as a psychotherapist, you're insistent, and most good medical practitioners are insistent, that clinical work has to be based on very clear observation, the monitoring of outcomes. So has this been successful? Has it not been successful? And of course, longer term research. So keeping a very close eye on the outcomes of medical intervention, researching the usefulness or otherwise of medical intervention, and really observing patients. I mean, even to me, a non-medical person, that makes perfect sense. But that very often just didn't happen with gender identity development services, did it? In terms of, I mean, one of the most shocking things that has come out in recent years is that the question of how many autistic kids were being put forward for gender transition, often medical intervention. How many of these gender confused kids were autistic? Even a question like that, which would seem pretty fundamental to the question of why these kids are going forward for intervention and whether or not it should be provided, that would seem to be a pretty central question. How many of them are on the autism spectrum? Even something like that wasn't monitored properly or checked or analyzed or even recorded and researched. So is that how bad it got, where even a question like that, which would strike even the lay person as pretty important, was just being pushed to one side?
I don't think they think of themselves as being a medical service. You see, they think of them as like customer choice. And then you don't have to ask these sorts of questions about comorbidity or long-term outcomes. You know, the customer wants things to be a particular way, and they want you to deliver what they want. And this is very different from medical practice, as you said. I'm glad you mentioned observation. I mean, a lot of, you know, medical ethics is about, okay, you've got your experience and your views, but you're always interested in observing to see whether you're right and moderating, you know, what you think on the basis of clinically what you see in front of you. That sort of medical observation and experience. Then you've got research in which you're doing randomized controlled trials to see whether your hypothesis about what helps does help or not. So you've got all these objective measures. You're not just going with what you feel. There's the sort of science that needs to back up your clinical view. And you mentioned earlier before, it'd be usual to have various different debates about what the patient's problem is and what the solution is. And all treatments have got upsides and downsides. So you expect some sort of discussion about, you know, whether the treatment you're going to embark on is going to do more harm than good. All of that is missing in these cultures where you've got, you know, well, we're right, the kid's right, they should be able to transition. And anybody who questions that is treated as a right-wing bigot, you know, who just wants to control people. I'm not interested in controlling people. I am interested in understanding people in the first instance. And I'm also very wary that psychiatry has got a track record of occasionally doing things which are extremely harmful. You know, lobotomies in the 1950s, 20,000 lobotomies were done. When I first started training as a psychiatric nurse, you'd see people and they weren't like people who got chronic long-standing difficulties. They were like shells of a person. And yeah, we did 20,000 lobotomies in the 1950s, no evidence. Lobotomies haven't been done in this country for the past 20 years. I mean, the whole thing was ditched. It was a bad experiment. So, you know, mental health has got previous on this.
It's such an important observation. And I've often found myself thinking, is this new form of medical experimentation, I suppose, on kids who are confused about their gender, is this the new lobotomy? Is this a thing that we will look back on with the same kind of horror that we now look back on lobotomies? And I think it very probably is. But I did want to ask you specifically about the puberty blocker regime. As you said earlier, not all kids were put on the medical pathway, but some were. They were prescribed with puberty blockers. Again, I'm saying this as a layperson, a non-expert. It has always seemed pretty horrendous to me, the very idea of blocking puberty, preventing the onset of this incredibly important process in every person's life, the transition from childhood to adulthood. As you said earlier, it can be a rocky road. That will ring true with many people. It's a confusing time. There's huge pressure. You have to think about sexuality, adulthood, all those things that you're kind of pushed towards very quickly by the rush of hormones through your body. So it's not an easy time, but it is absolutely essential to human life that you go through puberty. And of course, puberty blocking drugs play a particular role in other cases. So when a kid has precocious puberty, which can be incredibly distressing, and some form of medical intervention is required in order to alleviate the distress and the physical changes happening in very, very young children. But with the prescription of puberty blockers to gender-confused kids, just tell us a little bit about what you think the dangers are there. I mean, you've already nodded towards some of the physical consequences that can take place, infertility, inability to have an orgasm, and so on. But also there is potential mental consequences as well, isn't there, in terms of if you're using a drug to try to fix what is probably a complex mental problem.
I mean, there's so much cod science around this area washing around. One of the things that was stated was you can stop puberty and then you can turn it on like a tap. Anyone who knows anything about medicine can tell you, you know, you've got windows in which things happen in infancy, in adolescence, you know, and if you suddenly turn off the puberty. You can't just turn it on like a tap. This has been a fiction. The problem that people will be shocked to get their head around, of course, is the endocrinologists have sort of gone along with this. There's a couple of endocrinologists in America. We've got a couple here. But by and large, endocrinologists have sort of gone along with this. Sue struggled to get people to sort of put in witness statements for the judicial review. But I defy an endocrinologist to say to me, oh, you could just stop puberty, even the psychological effects, because the confusion you talk about, which often kids who are quite vulnerable want to get rid of, the confusion that happens with puberty, quite rightly, as you say, but you're with your peers and you're all struggling with the different groups, how you're going to manage this thing called adolescence and puberty. And you've got people who are rushing towards adulthood and sexual relations and people hiding in their rooms, all manner of people in sort of across the group. But if you take the kid out of their peer group and put them back a few years, you know, it's not a neutral act. This is the thing that people claim. It's a neutral act. It's not a neutral act. You're putting someone behind in their class, not just psychologically in terms of learning maths, but physiologically. And there has not been enough study, but the studies that are coming out are showing all sorts of worrying things about brain development. You know, there's a rush of brain development that occurs, is brought along by puberty hormones. And in terms of the development of your genitals, that is also interfered with. So this is nonsense. It's a neutral act. The other bit of nonsense that was, you know, exposed in the trial was there's this idea, it was called pause for thought. You could put kids who are not ready for puberty on puberty blockers. And then, as I say, you know, when they're a little bit more mature, you turn the tap on and everything's okay. The fact is once kids got on the medical pathway, it's a conveyor belt. It leads on to cross-sex hormones. Something like 98% of kids who started on puberty blockers went on to cross-sex hormones. If you carry on with cross-sex hormones, you end up being infertile. So you're starting with a kid at 11 or 12 being put on puberty blockers. You're ending up with a sterile kid at 19. You know, so a lot of false science bandied around to keep people like me quiet, basically, but confusing for parents, very confusing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the distress of parents who have a kid who feels confused about their gender and they don't really know what to do about it. And that's where the failings of these services are most clear, because you ought to be able to talk to parents in a reasoned, evidence-based way about how their kid might be treated, but instead their kid was often rushed onto these various different pathways, a real failure of children and a real failure of parents by these services. So I want to ask you about some of these kids themselves. So we've already touched upon the fact that relatively significant numbers of them are on the autism spectrum, and this was not analysed or recorded or thought about very much by the Gender Identity Development Services. A lot of them also are the kind of kids who would have turned out to be gay. They would have become young gay men. They would have become young lesbians. And you and others have talked about almost a culture of homophobia. So often these kids would present with their gender confusion, sometimes because they were suffering from some forms of homophobia, whether in the family home, whether internally, you know, this girl just didn't want to be a lesbian and thought it was a bit icky and not very nice and not very interesting. And so they would present for transition in order that they would become the supposedly correct sex. To me, that's deeply disturbing, because it almost creates a situation where in 21st century Britain, we were carrying out medical interventions on gay kids. And that seems to me something from far more tyrannical regimes than ours. Explain a little bit about the extent to which the Gender Identity Development Service almost accidentally became a homophobic system, which was affirming the mythical genders of kids who would very often just grow up to be healthy gay adults.
Let me give you two pieces of my experience. One was that this is something that was in Dave Bell's report and very much was around in the JID service. And it's certainly true, you know, that it was a sort of internal homophobia, which the transition would then help to deal with. I have to say that in terms of our small private clinic, and just to say, This is not an overview. I'm not in a position to give an overview of all the kids. We get contacted by sceptical parents for a start. I'll just say we get three letters a week. The letters run like this. We'd like you to see our son or daughter. They've got neurodevelopmental problems and on the autistic spectrum. They never questioned their gender, but they went along to a CAM service or a gender identity service, and now they've got a fixed belief that the solution to their problems is transition. We're not against them transitioning when they reach adulthood, but we're very worried that they're being pushed down a road and they'll regret it. We've read what you say, and we'd like you to see them. We see a cross-section. Some kids are struggling with their homosexuality. We see kids who are on the autistic spectrum or have ADHD or eating disorders. One of the common elements to all those things is that in some senses they feel rather challenged by the conflicts and turmoil and confusion of puberty, as you've described it, and they're looking to control the sort of internal turbulence. They're not really ready for sexuality, as I said before. It's almost they want to pause the problem that sexuality brings. So our experience and our very small service is we get a range of people. You do get internalized homophobia, and sometimes the families you hear are homophobic and, you know, they'd rather the kid trans. But we get this sort of range that I've described. I was just going to come back to the autism thing, because, again, it was another thing that judges asked in the court case. The great thing about the court case is it really shone a light on what was going on in the service. And the judges said, look, we understand because of the sort of concrete thinking and the fear of emotional turbulence that autistic kids are very drawn towards this sort of black and white thinking that the gender ideology provides, the sort of certainty, get rid of confusion, he'd live in a certain world. And they said, well, you know, what numbers of autistic kids? They didn't collect the data. The judges sent them away to go and find the data in the notes, and they came back. They hadn't been collecting it. Again, my experience in the adult department, you're always collecting data for your, you know, reports back to the commissioners.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the most extraordinary elements of this scandal, the lack of those fundamental aspects of the medical approach, which is you record data, you observe, you make notes, you know, you have piles and piles of paper that tell you what has happened with particular patients, whether it was good, whether it was bad. And the lack of those processes in some of the gender development services, I think, is just extraordinary. And arguably one of the most shocking indictments of what was happening there, that they weren't doing the normal medical practitioner stuff. You said earlier, you made an interesting aside where you said that if someone says to you, I'm Henry VIII, you don't necessarily want to butt heads with that person. You don't want to shout them down and say, you're not Henry VIII, get a grip. But you do want to understand why they are saying something like this. And in the round, the various different elements of their lives and what they're experiencing internally and within their own community, perhaps, that has led them to this delusion. How do you see a boy claiming to be a girl or a girl claiming to be a boy? Do you see it on that same level, that this is, sad to say, a delusion, a delusional belief that doesn't have a basis in, certainly not in biological reality and not in social reality either? Do you see it as something that is indicative of a larger internal turmoil and confusions of the mind that requires a broad range of treatments? And therefore, I guess what I'm asking is, you don't accept the idea that they can shift from one gender to another, which is such a commonplace idea amongst the establishment these days that it can be difficult to push back against it.
Yeah, maybe the comparison with Henry VIII. Yes, that's a psychotic delusion. And you'd say, my thought would be, well, maybe you've been nasty to your wife, you've had an argument or something, you're trying to think, well, why Henry VIII, you know? No, I'd put it on the spectrum with what I would call an overvalued belief, where your thinking is orientated around a particular belief. It doesn't mean you're completely out of touch with reality. It's almost as if reality sort of doesn't count. It sort of runs alongside. So that, in a sense, and you put the belief system as your preeminent organizing factor. And often what you find is you can't be clear what it's based on. You say, but what's so awful about being a boy? You want to transition to being a girl. What was bad about John? You know, sounds like you didn't really like John very much, or there was a problem with John. I wouldn't put it as concretely as that, but I'm thinking, what was the problem with John? You know, because you can't get rid of elements of your psyche. You can't have them surgically removed. So you're keeping in mind, you've got someone who very much wants to go in a particular direction. They've created a sort of avatar of themselves, which I think they believe is going to be the solution to their difficulties. And then you're curious about these unwanted aspects. A lot of these kids have got internal sort of self-hatred. They're suffering from a sort of, it's like a chronic depression in which they hate imperfections, and it sort of gets lumbered in one area which they feel they're going to get rid of. And you're curious about what it is that means that they can't tolerate that the imperfections. Part of development, isn't it, is coming to terms with your various different imperfections and foibles, and trying to sort of do what you can about what you can do things about. And with other things you're having to live with. It gets easier as you get older, when you begin to realise we're all making the best of a bad job. That's difficult for a kid to do, but you're trying to say, but why can't you tolerate the imperfections? What's that about? But I put it in the category of an overvalued belief. It's not psychotic.
Yeah, that's a very good way to describe it. And you mentioned earlier that some of the kids presenting with gender confusion often have eating disorders as well and various other comorbidities. And I do often think about this gender issue alongside something like anorexia, where, again, I guess you could describe that as a kind of dangerously singular belief amongst young girls predominantly, that if they control their weight, then everything will be fine. And if they just have severe control over that, then their life will make sense. And, you know, just as you wouldn't say to a girl suffering from anorexia, yes, you are fat. Yes, you should starve yourself. Yes, you should consume only 300 calories a day. No serious medical practitioner would say something like that to a girl. They would instead look into what was causing this condition. So also, surely you shouldn't say to a kid who presents with gender confusion, yes, this is the answer to your every problem. If we can just affirm your identity and get you on that medical pathway, then everything else will be right. So it really is a failure of psychotherapy, medical services more broadly, that medical practitioners accepted this singular belief that kids were presenting with, isn't it? And a failure just to look at the round at what is going on in this child's life.
It's very odd what's happened, because for me, this is a developmental problem, the same as self-harm, the same as anorexia in previous generations. And no, you wouldn't just go along with it, the idea that you can starve yourself and you create this sort of perfect version of yourself where you control everything, no appetites, no desires, you're a sort of self-sufficient system. And the sort of psychological makeup is very similar in a way, that wish to control the mind and also the control of others, that often the parents are quite so frightened about the threat of suicide, another piece of COD science. These kids are no more likely to kill themselves than other disturbed adolescents. They're in the same range. There's also the threat that you know kids will cut off contact, and they get support from the online groups to say your parents are all bigots. And so the parents have got such a difficult job. They're dealing with the kid, but they're also made to feel like they're the problem sometimes by the services. And that's the thing that is different from self-harm and anorexia. It is this political interference that has stopped us doing our ordinary job as mental health practitioners. I don't see this as particularly different to these other developmental problems. What I see as being different is the politicization, which has pushed out ordinary clinical thinking and practice.
Yeah, that's very well described. And it's that process of politicization, the kind of pollution of these services by ideological thinking, and that extraordinary pressure from outside of the medical world, where you have the very noisy transgender movement and huge wings of the establishment going along with it. And, you know, those mantras, trans women are women, which we're all expected to repeat like a, you know, religious chant. When you have a society that has this culture, it's going to be very difficult, I think, even for medical services to withstand that pressure. And it seems that the ideology did wash over a lot of the gender identity development services in the NHS. While we've been talking, you've mentioned a couple of other people. You've mentioned Susan Evans, your wife, who was a nurse therapist at Tavistock, who was one of the first, I think, to raise the alarm about what was going on there. And in 2005, she did this, especially about the speed with which some kids were being put on the medical pathway. You've mentioned Dr. David Bell, who was a consultant psychiatrist at Tavistock, who published a really critical report about the gender identity development services. And there's, of course, your voice as well, raising these concerns for some time. And there have been other voices too. That's another aspect of this I find quite shocking, because no one can say, well, why weren't we talking about this? Why weren't people raising concerns? Now that we have the CAS review, which I think has opened lots of people's eyes to these problems, people are saying, how could this happen? But the truth of the matter is that there were whistleblowers. There were people from within the heart of these institutions who were raising concerns. Why do you think that fell on deaf ears so often? Is that another consequence of the authoritarian culture that swirls around this issue, that it was really difficult for people to cut through into the public debate?
Yeah, I mean, just to say about the Taylor report, David Taylor was the medical director in 2005 after Sue blew the whistle. He brought in a very senior psychiatrist. He was taking it very seriously. I was one of the managers. I talked to other directors. None of us ever saw the report. So the Tavistock's culture is a sort of one of discussion between the departments, as it is clinically. So we'd always see the reports from other departments. That report was buried. And I had an interest in finding out what was in the report. Never came across the report. That was why I resigned, because I could see the same thing happening with Dave Bell. They just wanted to use the current medical director's report to bury Dave Bell's report. If the problem hadn't been brought outside the trust, then in a way the sort of wranglings which would go on from time to time within the trust, they wouldn't have got out. I think it was bringing the issue outside the trust. And then I came across journalists who did know about the problem and the history of the problem. And then we got together with some people from across the pond who were also struggling with the issue. And then taking the judicial review, I think there's all sorts of factors which brought it to light. But in a way, they're all fighting against this thing, which is sort of closing down thought and discussion. I mean, people talk about cancelling culture all the time. Certainly, there's an interesting sort of follow through, because with the kids, they're very much wary of your curiosity about who they are. They want to bring you into a sort of narrow discussion. It's all about gender. If you're a skilled psychotherapist, you sort of get them interested in themselves. And as I've said many times, opening things out. But they can feel very easily assaulted. It's as if they said, I've got this certainty. This is the solution. I've got rid of all these confusions and doubts about myself. Now you're asking me questions. You're making me feel worse. And that's what goes on. And that's the skill of the therapist in trying to say, yeah, okay, I get you feel uncomfortable. But, you know, being so certain about these things is not always a helpful thing. You know, you're moving with them in trying to open things out. But thinking is a real threat and challenge. It is at an individual clinical level. And then you get into the culture, and then you've got the politicization, where if you question anything, you're a bigot and a transphobe and patriarchal, you just want to control how people live their lives. So you're dismissed, you're accused of being bigoted. My view would be actually that's a projection of the bigoted feeling, because we're about opening things out and thinking about all the various rich ways that a person is an individual, not trying to push them down a narrow gender stereotype of boys are logical and play football and girls like dance and wear pink. You know, that's a very regressive set of beliefs, but that's the way you get discredited and shut up. It's by the accusations of bigotry. But I think opening things up for external scrutiny has been so important.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book, and I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology. And it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now on with the show.
No, I really agree on the bigotry point. And, you know, if you look up the dictionary definition of the term bigotry, it really does mean intolerance of other people's beliefs and arguments. And that is a perfect description of the other side in this discussion. I often find myself thinking I'm not going to be called a bigot by people who shout down women and want men to have the right to go into women-only spaces and who think it's okay to give drugs to gay kids. You know, I'm happy to be called a bigot by all sorts of people if they want to do that, but not by people who behave in those ways, which I would consider to be genuinely bigoted in different ways. I want to ask you about a little bit more about the culture around this issue, as you've described it, and the cancel culture around it and the difficulty people have in speaking out. So Dr. Hilary Cass, who spearheaded the Cass Review, she has now said that at the moment she's not going on the bus, she's not going on public transport because she's had security advice saying don't do it, you know, keep a low profile. And she quite diplomatically describes that as inconvenient. I think it's an outrage that she can't move about in the public sphere as she wishes, because, of course, there has been such a rash and in some cases just deranged response to her review from noisy activists, from their so-called allies, even from sections of the media and the political class who have misrepresented her review and described it as unscientific and so on. And they're basically, as Hilary Cass herself has said, these people are spreading misinformation about her review. And she suffered as a consequence. She now feels less free because of the vile threats, as she refers to them, that she's been receiving. When I see this stuff, firstly, I think the cancel culture element is such an important part of why we weren't able to have these discussions. But at the same time, isn't it now reaching ahead? Surely more people out there will realize that if a leading pediatrician cannot carry out a cool-headed, evidence-based study into a National Health Service provision without suffering violent threats, without suffering abuse, more people are surely bound to realize that we have a real problem with the infusion of this element of health with ideology and with intolerance. I think it will probably open more people's eyes to that.
I think that one of the things that is sort of unhealthy in individuals, is unhealthy in society, is to develop a sort of moral superiority whereby you're intolerant of imperfections and grey areas and disagreements. You know, you want a sort of everybody fitting in with your particular views. It's a sort of tyranny, a moral tyranny, and individuals suffer from it, you know, because they can't tolerate, you know, the fact that they're not the perfect being that they would like to be. And then, you know, we don't control ourselves, our thoughts and our imperfections, as I was saying earlier. In medical services, it's the antithesis of good medical ethics. Like I said, you know, nothing is off limits. You should be free to think all sorts of irreverent thoughts and to challenge your own thinking and look at things from different points of view. And that has been disallowed. And then it's getting into our sort of civic debates, you know, certain things you can't think and you're immediately dismissed as, you know, as an awful human being just for thinking and saying something. I mean, I think this is unhealthy individually, it's unhealthy clinically, and it's unhealthy socially.
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, not only do we not see the benefit, but you can quite clearly see the harms of that kind
of approach. And just a couple more questions for you, Marcus, before I let you go. The other element of this, which is, I think, speaks to the kind of really problematic naivety of sections of the political class, is the crusade to outlaw what they refer to as conversion therapy. That worries me in particular, because often what they mean by conversion therapy is not just that old image of a priest trying to exorcise the, you know, the homosexual demons from a child, which we can all agree is, you know, unscientific and intolerant. We all agree about that. But often what they mean by conversion therapy is attempts by medical practitioners and even parents to discourage a child from affirming their gender identity, i.e. discourage a young boy from becoming supposedly a girl and vice versa. So in that instance, when you have politicians making the case for the criminalization of conversion therapy, they're essentially arguing for the criminalization of what a good therapist ought to do, what people like you should be doing, which is not just nodding along when a 12-year-old girl says, I want to be a boy, but instead looking at the broader elements of her life and why she might feel like this. I mean, there is a real danger, isn't there, if we go forward with the criminalization of so-called conversion therapy, that just having a conversation or treating these kids with a bit more respect could itself become a risky business.
We met with a couple of people from the Equalities Commission, and they asked Sue and I on a couple of occasions what we thought. What you need, what I've described, is experienced clinicians. And actually, experienced clinicians have got choices. They don't have to take on difficult cases. And people stay away from these cases because of the political environment and because of the vexatious nature of the issue. We've met with hundreds of psychotherapists, and a lot of them are saying, we won't take on these kids. Now, if you then add legislation, more people will be walking away, and you'll be left with the least experienced people who are then really up against, you know, the kids' sort of demands. And that's not helpful for anyone. And we said this to the people from the Equalities Commission. They said there would all be all sorts of provisos to protect clinicians. But honestly, any more obstacles to working in this area is difficult enough as it is. The other thing to say is, I can say the whole idea of adding the T to conversion therapy, you know, it's a straw man. I mean, it's all just created as another sort of scary figure that, you know, we've got to fight this problem of conversion therapy. I was in charge of the adult department at the Tavistock Clinic. That is the biggest psychotherapy training centre in this country, maybe in Europe, who knows? And I've been a manager there for 20 years. And I dealt with the complaints for a long period of time. I've never come across one complaint that a therapist was trying to convert the patient to their way of thinking. This is unethical. My job is not to tell the patient in front of me how to live their life. My job is to think seriously about who they are so that they can make good decisions about the life that they want to lead. Obviously, with kids, you know, there is a requirement to think, at what point can you make informed decisions about, say, medical transition? So I'm not for transitioning kids. There's no evidence for this at all, and it would be extremely harmful legislation if it was brought in. And if anyone wants to invite me to the House of Commons or to speak about this, I think I've been in a very good position to speak with some authority. I just never come across any psychotherapist who's trying to convert anyone to, you know, their ideal of how they should be.
Okay, my final question for you is about the future, I guess, and what you think might happen next. So we've had the CAST review, we've had criticisms being raised by you and other people for some time. We live on Turf Island. You know, the UK is often referred to as Turf Island because there are so many so-called TERFs, gender-critical voices, who are not buying into this stuff. So Britain has become a very interesting hotbed of pushback against some of this stuff that we've been talking about. And I wonder what you think will happen next. So we've got, you know, a very serious situation where there are significant numbers of young people out there who may have had double mastectomies, who may have taken drugs that will possibly render them infertile or sexually inactive, and many of whom will no doubt develop later confusions in life because they've gone through a medical process to address what was probably an underlying therapeutic problem. And as you said earlier, you know, it's very possible that these are the lobotomies of our time, unnecessary and very severe medical interventions into the healthy bodies of people to try to fix an underlying problem. So given all of that, what do you think will happen next? Do you think we'll see an explosion in legal actions? Do you think we'll see an explosion in unhappiness amongst trans people in the future as they realize what has been done to them? Where do you think this will go next?
One thing to say is I don't think everybody who transitions is going to be a disaster. There'll be a proportion that will make good transitions. My problem with it has been the lack of caution and the lack of safeguarding. What you're seeing with Sweden and the Scandinavian countries that were ahead of the curve, they're all looking at their research now and scrutinizing it. A lot of them are coming to the conclusion that Cass did, that a lot of these claims are based on substandard research, and they're all rowing back. Hilary Cass, for me, has broken the back of this with the thoroughness with which she's gone about her job. She employed a top team. She's got in Simon Wesley, who is our lead psychiatric researcher. And he doesn't do anything by half measures. So she's not just, you know, sort of saying, well, I've done my report and that's that. She's setting up a whole infrastructure. We can really look clinically at what goes on with these kids. So I think that she's done a fantastic job, and it's made a lot of difference, partly in this area, but partly to put science and expertise back where it belongs, you know, and to sort of push to one side the simplistic, you know, loud voice claims that we tend to get bullied by, you know, the sort of more complex scientific arguments that she puts in. We need a lot more of Hilary Cass in the various aspects of our lives. And some of the loud, simplistic voices need to be sort of quietened down a little bit, as far as I'm concerned. I think that there will be more medical claims. I mean, one of the things that people have hidden behind is the WAPATH, the World Organization that gives advice on gender medicine. Stephen Levine, the godfather of this area, was involved in setting up WAPATH. He left because it became so politicized, and he realized it was a political organization, not a clinical one. That was a long time ago. So what people have done is they've gone, I saw the head of Stonewall say, well, I was given bad advice. I suspect the advice is from WAPATH. Everybody knows that whole institution was captured. There's been no science going on in WAPATH for a very long time. And WAPATH needs to be disbanded, and the fact that they've been purporting to be a clinical advisory service when they're actually political activists, really, they need to be discredited and got rid of, because a lot of people have sort of hidden behind their advice, I think knowing that they're a sort of proxy for political activism, really. You know, hopefully Cass has sort of punctured this sort of cultural environment in which none of this can be challenged. And all sorts of people are starting to step up and say, actually, no, it's all wrong. I see the Royal College of Psychiatrists, I gave them a bit of a hard time on Twitter and on a podcast today, because I said, well, where have you been? But okay, fair enough. You know, they've made a statement saying they're completely behind Cass, and we need more people joining the bandwagon and finding the courage, particularly our medical institutions and our politicians, to stand up to this sort of bullying dialogue and not leave it to Hilary Cass to take the brunt of this. We need much more room for complex thought, debate and discussion, and drown out some of the noisier, more bullying elements of our social debates, discussions.
Marcus, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.